are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, October 17th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael and Sam Tuesday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Sam's basically brand-new conversation with Corey Robin about the Republican grift, Republican scam artistry, and where we are today. More Republican judges confirmed the Trump nomination process moving forward fast. More judges, almost I think twice the amount of judges for circuit courts confirmed at this point in his term as compared to President Obama. Puerto Rico facing ongoing devastation, even as the Jones Act is no longer waived. The Iraqi national government moving against the Kurds, retaking Kirkuk. Does this mean that the northern Iraqi Kurds and the Syrian and Turkish Kurds are going to set aside their policy differences and reignite with their shared Kurdish nationalism, even as the world expresses its ongoing support for the Iran deal? Macron flying to Iran as Haley stumbles on TV. Popovich calls out Trump, and Trump wants everybody to know that unlike Obama, he does actually acknowledge the deaths of soldiers. Trump having to withdraw his nomination for head of the DEA. Why? Well, his previous background as head of the Zetas caused some controversy. No, I'm just kidding. But his previous background is one of the main bagmen for the pharma industry in Congress, who was pretty active in at least setting up some of the policy that allowed for the opioid crisis, and his relationship with one of his aides, who's a top lobbyist for that industry, didn't exactly help. All that, plus Syrian militias taking back Raqqa from ISIL. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. How's everybody doing?
I'm well.
Matt as well. Jamie, how are you?
I'm well as well.
It's good to see everybody. Patrick off mic. Brendan. He got a thumbs up. That doesn't even goad you. What's your middle name? Which is? He's not giving out his middle name. Okay, got it. It's his mother's maiden name, so I'll just make one up in the fun half. Let's get to this sound. Apparently, recently, and I have a couple of U.S. special forces were killed in Chad. The Chadian government has actually recently announced that they're no longer going to be coordinating in the fight against Boko Haram because of their implication of President Trump's immigration and visitation policies with regards to Chad. So they've reacted to it. I think if you asked Trump if King Jaffe Jofer was the president of Chad, he might not know what you were talking about, but that's just because he hasn't seen Coming to America, not because he knows Chad is actually a country. And apparently President Trump was late in sending or kind of publicly acknowledging the loss of these soldiers' lives. And he responded to a question about this during a press conference with Mitch McConnell in a manner that you would probably expect at this point for him to take.
Heard anything from you so far about the soldiers that were killed in Niger, and what do you have to say about
this? I've written them personal letters. They've been sent or they're going out tonight, but they were written during the weekend. I will, at some point during the period of time, call the parents and the families, because I have done that traditionally. I felt very, very badly about that. I always feel badly. It's the toughest calls I have to make are the calls where this happens. Soldiers are killed. It's a very difficult thing. Now, it gets to a point where, you know, you make four or five of them in one day. It's a very, very tough day. For me, that's by far the toughest. So the traditional way, if you look at President Obama and other presidents, most of them didn't make calls. A lot of them didn't make calls. I like to call when it's appropriate, when I think I'm able to do it. They have made the ultimate sacrifice. So generally, I would say that I like to call. I'm going to be calling them. I want a little time to pass. I'm going to be calling them. I have, as you know, since I've been president, I have. But in addition, I actually wrote letters individually to the soldiers we're talking about, and they're going to be going out either today or tomorrow. Yes.
That made total sense. First, I would just a brief correction. The soldiers were four special services officers were killed in Niger. President Obama, of course, did call the families of fallen soldiers, but it did get us thinking, I guess to be fair to Trump, that those calls might have been hard for President Obama because he had to pretend that he was upset about the deaths of Yacoubian white devils in the course of imperialist fighting. Hello, Mrs. Smith. Sorry, kid died. Look, I got a Kendrick Lamar meeting at 2, so I'm going to need to wrap this up. Allahu Akbar. Trump, somebody tweeted this the other night, that Trump really is kind of, like, I think that the frame for Republicans generally that everything is just about tearing down Obama's legacy is not the right way to read it, because there is a broader policy set in play that transcends Obama. But I think with Trump specifically, I mean, he's basically a stalker. I mean, that's like the only way to describe his relationship with President Obama. You guys spend a third of your life in your sheets. Are they taking care of you the way they should be? Introducing brooklinen.com. High quality sheets and bedding at a price that won't keep you up at night. Founded in April 2014. Brooklinen offers simple, beautiful home essentials without the luxury price. It's the wow, Jamie's super excited. She's rushing to get on the site right now. It's the fastest growing bedding brand in the world because people love these products. Their sheets have over 12,000 five-star reviews. That is a lot. Plus, they have versatile colors and patterns that complement any decor. This is luxury bedding, underpriced. You have to try these sheets today. Sam is constantly raving about his Brooklinen sheets. I know as soon as I switch my sheet game up, which I'm actually going to have to do soon, I will be definitely on the Brooklinen bandwagon. And it's not just Sam. I've actually asked some other people about them. And this is something like I'm embarrassed I'm late to. I'm like the opposite of Matt and his early adoption of things like this. Try these sheets I know that you will love them as well. Brooklinen has an exclusive offer for my listeners. Get $20 off rather, and free shipping when you use promo code MAJORITY at brooklinen.com. In fact, Brooklinen is so confident that you'll love your new sheets that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all their sheets and comforters. There's no reason not to give these sheets a try. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code MAJORITY at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Brooklinen. These are the best sheets ever. Did you guys get a chance? I think we had the Nature Box snacks before the new members of our militia came on board. Matt, do you remember the Nature Box snacks?
Yeah, I had mine. I can't remember what I had, but it was banana flavored and really good.
I had some of the banana flavored one, and then there was like an Asian one, like a kind of like some type of like, I forget the name. Anyways, we had Nature Box in here for probably about an hour, and then we just mashed all of them. Primarily Sam. Sam's like a vulture. He's like, nom, 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 nom. Fueled his energy to read a Social Security actuarial table. But they were delicious. When it comes to snacks, sometimes it feels like the only options are delicious and a billion calories or boring and tasteless. But it doesn't have to be that way. Up your snack game with Nature Box. Nature Box has over 100 snacks that taste good and are all made from high-quality, simple ingredients. That means no artificial colors, flavors, or sweeteners, Matt, so that you can feel good about what you're eating. Oh, right. There was the Honey Dijon pretzels. Those were the ones that I really liked. And there's vanilla bean wafers. The Honey Dijon pretzels were perfect for me. That's like exactly. And what I liked about the vanilla bean wafers was that they weren't too sweet. I'm like not a huge sweets guy, so I was surprised that I liked them. They satisfy, they did. In fact, it's true. They satisfy my sweet tooth without making me feel guilty. Plus, they add new snacks inspired by real customer feedback, the latest food trends, and professional chefs every month. It's so simple. Just go to naturebox.com. Choose the snacks you want, and NatureBox will deliver them right to your door. There's no risk. If you ever try a snack you don't like, NatureBox will replace it for free.
A NatureBox snack, not just like any snack.
Yeah, you can't just send them some nonsense like snack.
I had the Snickers bar. It was unsatisfying. Yeah, and I have some NatureBox.
And of course it will be, because it's not NatureBox. It's all going to be unsatisfying. They only mean NatureBox snacks. Exactly. Very lawyerly of you, Matt. I appreciate that. So you're sure to find your new snack obsession. And right now, you'll save more. NatureBox is offering our listeners 50% off of your first order when you go to naturebox.com/majority. That's naturebox.com/majority for 50% off of your first order. That's insane. naturebox.com/majority. Tonight, 7 p.m., Michael Brooks Show. We're live. We're talking about Catalonia, the EU, and socialism. Mike Hanna from Al Jazeera, the UN correspondent, is going to break down the Iran fallout, what's happening in Kurdistan. Right Wing Mandela is hanging out with Gorka. We have some newfound audio. I'm talking about the bigger strategic push behind Medicare and for all, and why we need it, why it isn't just a moral issue, it's a strategic one, and some some more follow-up on those Barack Obama calls to fallen soldiers. They're actually really disturbing, and I don't know if revealing them to the public is a good idea, but I think we have a journalistic obligation to do so. All that, 7 p.m. live tonight. Check it out. Thanks, everybody, for great feedback on that show. We'll be right back with Sam's interview with Corey Robin, and then we'll all see you in the fun half.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Corey Robin. He is a professor of politics at Brooklyn College and author of The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Donald Trump. And this is the second edition. I think we had you on for the first edition, and you have updated it with an assessment of our most recent president, as he is, addressing the question of his conservative bona fides.
Yes, that's right. I wouldn't say most recent president. He's the current president, unfortunately.
It's true. He's both the most recent and the current, I guess. I'm already imagining a different day. But yeah. All right. Well, let's go into this, because this is, I mean, and you're approaching this from a philosophical and ideological perspective, because, I mean, what's interesting, and I guess maybe we'll circle back around to this, is to the relationship between Donald Trump and Republicans. But let's get there after we talk about his relationship to conservatism. You start off, at least in the piece that I've read of yours, talking about the question of Donald Trump's ability, as you read The Art of the Deal, his ability to jump, to contradict himself within almost a span of just a few sentences.
Yeah, so it was a really weird experience. Earlier this year, I think it was around January, February, I started reading The Art of the Deal, I felt like it was time to kind of figure out who this guy was and what he was about. And let me preface this by saying there was a big article in The New Yorker, I think that Jane Mayer wrote, where she interviewed Tony Schwartz, who was the ghostwriter of The Art of the Deal. Donald Trump didn't write it. The ghostwriter did. And the ghostwriter, Tony Schwartz, said he felt really bad about the book because he felt like it had really given this image of Trump that was really positive, that it had burnished his reputation. And so I was expecting to read, you know, this kind of triumphalist statement. But if you actually read it, and I wouldn't even say pretty carefully, if you just read it, it reveals just what a horror show this guy is in all sorts of ways. So to get back to your question, and so that's why I take the book seriously, and I think it's actually a good statement of Trump and Trumpism. So all throughout the book, he makes claims, and as you said, literally like on the next page, sometimes even the next paragraph, he contradicts himself. And sometimes it's comical. So he makes a big deal in his opening chapter about he just doesn't do lunch, you know, lunch is for wimps kind of a thing. And then I counted the number of times by the time, and I stopped, but I think by page 100, he's already gone out to lunch three times. And it stuck to me as very funny, just the kind of the bravado by which he says things. And then, you know, and then the casualness with which he then admits that the opposite is the truth. And this isn't just a kind of a personal thing or a foible of Trump. I think it's important because, to step back now, because people will point to these contradictions, and they always have, and they say, aha, you know, he's inconsistent, he lies, he says X, then he does Y, and all that. But what people don't realize is this is actually a very old trope on the right, going way back to the reaction against the French Revolution. And the reason why it is such an old trope is that the French Revolution, one of the promises of the French Revolution was that it was going to reorganize society in a rational, reasonable, just way. You know, the metric system, all these kinds of things that they introduced into society to make it more orderly. You know, they reorganized the regions and new departments. They declared the year one. They did all these things, a new kind of a calendar that was supposed to be more rational. And conservatives reacted in horror against this because they felt like the essence of life and the essence of society is not rationality, but irrationality, that contradiction and inconsistency and paradox are what it means to be human. And it's what also, particularly in a society that's unequal, that's hierarchical, like a monarchy, right, where there's domination and subjection, you couldn't have reason and consistency be the rule because the whole point is that people are different and society is organized hierarchically, so you have to have different rules for different people. So inconsistency and contradiction and paradox have really been very important to the conservative tradition from the very beginning.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead. Continue. I mean, the utility was this is the way we don't have to justify why we might have access to more resources or control of people because that's life. I mean, that's the utility there.
Right. And so, you know, I don't want to make, you know, Trump is not a reader of conservative philosophy. He's not steeped in Edmund Burke or anything like that. So I'm not making that claim. But the way in which he kind of, you know, says one thing and then, you know, with a nudge and a wink says another, is something that you see in the conservative tradition, you know, throughout. You know, George W. Bush, people forget this, even though he wasn't so long ago. The thing that conservatives loved about George W. Bush was, as Fred Barnes put it in his book, that he was the rebel in chief. Right. He was like a James Dean sort of character, they thought, I'm not saying he was, right, who could thumb his nose at all those fancy Ivy League professors with all their rules and their political correctness and all their strictures about how everything should be done in a certain kind of a way. And George W. Bush didn't give a crap. That's what made him authentic. That's what made him a real, you know, populist. If you read Peggy Noonan on Ronald Reagan, it was the same kind of a thing. that, and so what I said, you know, in this, in the book, is that, you know, Trump has the confidence of his contradictions, and that, you know, because it shows that he's just not a stuffed shirt. It shows that he's not a suit, no. You know, and that's important to his appeal.
All right. So, I mean, because and we should make that clear, right? I mean, like you say, he's not reading deep into conservative thought and adopting anything. It's just a question of like why he pops with
right.
with this ideology. And, you know, and I believe that like there's also and where does this fit into it? That there was, I seem to recall a quote from Gertrude Himmelfarb saying something to the effect about like the attacks on science were also of a, I guess, a similar utility where there can be no objective reality because you don't want anybody to be making those type of arguments where you need to have you know, the ability to say like, well, that's your set of facts and this is ours. And this is why things are.
Mm. I mean, I don't know the specific Gertrude Himmelfarb quote that you're referring to, but, you know, again, conservatives, you know, going way back have always been very leery of science. And it's not because they're anti-intellectual. I mean, what's fascinating is the strongest attacks on science on the right or on science as a kind of organizing principle, the reality principle, you might say, the strongest attacks on that have always come from intellectuals, from very serious thinkers. And there have been a multiple set of reasons, but I think for our purposes, maybe the most important one most recently was the famous Karl Rove quote that he said to the guy at Esquire.
Suskind, right.
Yeah, to Suskind, where he said, you know, you people are in the reality-based community. And by you people, he meant journalists, academics, the media, commentary, you know, intellectuals. And you guys go about and describe that reality. But we are, we being the Bush administration, we create reality. We are not slaves to reality. We don't hew to reality. We transform it. And once we are successful, you, intellectuals, journalists, and all the rest of it, will then describe our reality as if that were just the way of things. But what you don't know is we created that reality. And so conservatism has this very strong activist component that makes it very skeptical of the constraints of science. And there's a lot of other reasons why it has been critical of science, but I think that's a really important one that we have to acknowledge. And that, again, it's not that these are buffoons and idiots. It's that they understand in a certain way that that science is a knowledge of constraint. It's a knowledge of things as they are. And what conservatism has always been in the business of is things as they might be.
And why is that? I mean, why as they might be? Is it aspirational? I mean, why is that? I mean, I understand why they would attack science because it's constraining and it is, in some ways, it's equalizing, right? I mean,
right.
Two different
rules apply to everybody.
The rules apply to everybody. I can understand why they would be against it, but what is it about? Is it because they have some type of aspirational spirit, or is it just that as they could be, keeps people sort of like in the game? Is it like, you know, I'm a dog going around the track and there's the rabbit in front of me?
So I think there's a couple of reasons, but the first one I want to stress is the one you've just emphasized, which is that science, you know, in seeking to describe sort of general rules that apply, oftentimes presumes a universal human nature. It doesn't always, but it often does. And there's been a very strong element within conservatism that has resisted that. That has said, no, there is no such thing as that insofar as we have a human nature, it's that we're all created unequal, and that inequality is sown into the human condition. So to try to come up with a set of universal rules that would apply to everybody, not just in terms of biology and physicality, but then morally and politically, is, from the point of view of many conservatives, a disaster. So I think that's one part of it. But the second part of it is that there is at the heart of conservatism a vision. This is a kind of a political or a moral vision that the best man. It's often men, although it doesn't need to be, and that these are kind of what Keynes called animal spirits. These are people who are aristocratic in nature, who are able to dominate society. They don't bend their knee to society. They don't bend their will to. They impose their will upon society, and that this is not only good for them. This is also good for the rest of us. So I think that's a very strong element to that. Is that, you know, they have this vision of the noble man, who would not be so pedestrian as to have to concede to the reality of things as they are. So I think that's the second one. But then there's a third, and this is much, much more political and central to the argument of my book, which is that conservatism is a reactionary philosophy. And what it has always been reacting against are democratic, insurgent, emancipatory movements from below, particularly when those movements succeed. So the French Revolution, the emancipation of slaves, the New Deal, the Civil Rights Movement. These movements that transformed and made the world into a more equal place, a place where more people could enjoy freedom, conservatism is a project that seeks to undo that and undo it in real time. So the last thing that a conservative wants to be told is this is just reality. The reality is, African Americans are equal to white people. That's reality. Women are equal to men. That's reality. Conservatives have postulated a politics against that kind of dispensation. They have tried to undo these reforms. And if you have a kind of quietistic philosophy of accommodating reality, you can't undo things. This is why conservatism has always hated, this is getting ahead of ourselves, what they call the establishment. It's very interesting. If you read Barry Goldwater's The Conscience of a Conservative, which came out in 1960, another ghost-written book, by the way, the first page is an attack, and this is Mr. Conservative, right? It's attacked not on liberalism, not on the Democratic Party, not on the welfare state, not on the New Deal. It's an attack on the Republican establishment. Why? Because the Republican establishment has conceded to reality. It has adapted to reality. And what the conservative wants to do is to transform reality.
Okay, so let's put a pin in that and return that, because I want to just go back to that sort of notion of, so you have one part of that is that the desire, you know, and I guess seeing themselves on some level and the desire or the utility in wanting there to be an Ubermensch who has different rules, I guess, applied to them. But at the same time, you're saying that also it allows for them to see upstarts, people maybe participating in some type of emancipatory movement and saying, we don't have to accept this. They can return back into that place because there is no fundamental objective truth or reality that says that they should be equal in some fashion.
Right. What's interesting, though, in all of this, which I also stress in the book, and I think you sort of hinted at this, is that as much as they have contempt, conservatives, for these upstart insurgent groups, they oftentimes express a kind of envy of them because they see that what these groups have is a kind of energy, particularly when they're successful. And an energy and a vision to impose their will. And so there's a weird synergy that happens in conservatism whereby they, as much as they are expressing hostility to the left and to these emancipatory movements, they're also learning from those movements. They're also adapting to those movements and incorporating different themes. And so you see that process happen as well.
Well, give me an example of that, because I mean, the only thing I can imagine is like when you, as you're saying that, is just my experience of conservatives who, you know, I used to work with Janine Garofalo, and I used to just watch like how conservatives just like both hated her and desperately wanted to be sort of seen as being like cool, like literally wanting to be cool. And I just, only thing that keeps coming into my mind is that that free market Fonzie guy, I can't remember his name from Reason Magazine, who wears the leather coat, and the constant attempts of the right to say like we're the new counterculture, and it seems to last for like 6 months, and then it just sort of goes away for like 3 years, and they do it again. Is it the first time they've come to it?
Yeah, it's interesting that you use the word counterculture. There's a great article by a historian named Bethany Moreton in an anthology of essays called Rightward Bound, where she talks about how the business class in the 1970s created a counterculture around the free market. And they used to do things on campuses. They'd organize campus groups, and they'd have a battle of the bands. I mean, it sounds so dorky and ridiculous on the one hand, but they would, you know, they would have businessmen go and try to show that, you know, that we're hip and we're cool. I mean, in some ways Mad Men is a little bit, you know, about that. In its second phase, about how, you know, the sort of the Madison Avenue types kind of adapt to and incorporate the counterculture. But that's exactly what they did, was to try to create and profit from and use the counterculture, not just to sell products, but to sell capitalism as well. And so they did that. But again, not to get too fussy and antiquarian, this goes right back to Edmund Burke. So there he is, polemicizing against the French Revolution with every fiber of his being. He loathes it. But what he says throughout various texts is the revolutionaries, and then he starts talking about the Jacobins, are superiors in their talent and in their vision. And he says, if we are going to mount a force against this, our force has to at least approximate in some ways what they are doing. And what you could say what conservatism has always been since that moment is an attempt to try and do that, to try and approximate the force of the left. And so that's what makes conservatism such a dynamic force, is that it's not just defending these established hierarchies in a kind of fussy, who's that character from Gilligan's Island, the wealthy...
the millionaire, Mr. Howell?
Yeah. Yeah, Mr. They're not Thurston Howell, you know, Thurston right. Howell III or whatever his name was. They are instead trying to show exactly what you're talking about, that they are hip, that they have talent, you know, that they are culturally adept in all these different sorts of ways. And again, this is where we come back to Trump and why he's so important. And you see this in the Art of the Deal. He makes such a big deal about the fact that he doesn't carry a briefcase, that he doesn't have a schedule. He just goes to work, and he just kind of sees what happens. And it's very clear that he thinks that that's important to not just his success as a businessman, but to his brand. That's what people gravitate to in him. And I think at some level he's not wrong. You know, it's very telling in the Republican primary. You know, Ted Cruz gets set up as, you know, the kind of the Boy Scout. And Rubio gets set up as, you know, the guy who, you know, is trying, you know, will do whatever he needs, the brown noser. You know, Trump's appeal is that he breaks the rules. He's the bad boy.
I mean, was that...
And that's very critical.
Okay, so, all right. But there's a lot of different themes that go into Trump. And I almost, I want to just circle back to on this... The going back to the point about the attacks on science and reality are not anti-intellectual, but it seems like there's been a strain of anti-intellectualism that grows, and I think you talk about this in the book, and that's the populism, that it's sort of like there's an anti-intellectual streak, it seems to me, on some level. Trump embodies that, as did George W. Bush to a large extent, it seems to me, Is that a relatively new phenomenon, or is that just another way of basically of throwing off the establishment?
It's definitely a way of throwing off the establishment. It's also very old. I mean, Burke and Joseph de Maistre, who I also talk about, who's another reactionary against the French Revolution, they go after the Enlightenment philosophers. That's a word that recurs in Burke's attack on the revolution. This is a revolution of philosophers. My point was it's Burke and de Maistre, these guys, it's not as if these guys are hacks and hicks. Like, they're pretty smart intellectuals themselves. So it's this attack on reason and the life of the intellect oftentimes comes from people who are themselves intellectual. And that's been a very important, dimension of all this. But with regard to Trump, it's absolutely true that he makes the attack on intellectuals, and Bush did the same, a very big part, because, who are intellectuals? Who are academics? That's the politically correct police that is in alliance with the Democratic Party, with the feminists, and with the welfare state. And Trump did not invent this or pioneer this. You see this in Richard Nixon. You see this in Spiro Agnew, who's Nixon's...
Nattering Nabobs, that guy.
Yeah, exactly. Nattering Nabobs of negativism. And you saw it in a lot of the Reagan administration. But ironically, while all that's going on, what they're also doing is creating a whole cohort of very smart intellectuals and apparatchiks who are taking over the courts, undoing the regulatory agencies, and all the rest of it. So there's always this kind of double movement that's happening, denouncing intellectuals, but also creating your own cadre of counter-intellectuals.
So Trump is up there on stage with all these other Republicans, and one thing he has going for him is that he doesn't abide by the rules. He's a he's a counterculture figure. That politically incorrect and sort of rudeness of his plays into that. How much does the fact that he is supposedly a billionaire, let's stipulate that he is for the sake of this, like, how much does that, as he's on stage with the rest of them, seems to me also had an important force, because he's... The way that money is perceived, and I think you talk about how he sees money in The Art of the Deal, it's a score keep, right?
Yep.
And you got to wonder, like, what is it keeping score of? Like moral righteousness, just righteousness in some fashion. And that is very much, it seems to me, at the very least, a Republican, if not a conservative construct, because... It always struck me is that there was nothing anybody was going to say to him on that stage where it would have more credibility than what he says, because he's richer.
Yeah. So this is a really important theme, and this is, I would say, probably the thing that I looked at very closely in Trump and his rise and the way he talks and so forth. I don't want to get too deep into the history of this. There's been a long-running tension about money, about markets, and about capitalism on the right. I mean, the people always think that the right is just, automatically a free market, kind of a movement, and that actually historically is not the case. There are parts of the right that have been very critical. But there's also been a part of the right that has celebrated money and the market and capitalism, not because it's the most productive system, not because it's the most efficient system, not because it's a meritocratic system. Instead, the reason they've celebrated, and this is a big theme for Trump, is that it shows who is the strongest man, who is the greatest man. The man with the most money, the man who prevails in the market, is the best man that way. And only the market will reveal who the best man is, who is the one who's willing. And there's, these crazy stories in The Art of the Deal where he talks about, he had this vision of building this the biggest, the most beautiful, the most expensive atrium in the world or in the United States or something like that. And he put all of his money into it in Trump Tower in Manhattan. And everybody else, he said, wanted to copy it because it was so great. And then it becomes a kind of a moment of existential truth. Are they willing to pay the bill? And they're not. And at that moment, he says, they, you know, the men are separated from the boys. Because he was willing to put his all and to make this great thing, and they're not. So what the market is a kind of a, it's almost a kind of an identity politics. It reveals who people are in the way that people used to talk about the battlefield, let's say. You know, you really reveal who's the, you know, who's courageous and who's a coward by how they act on the battlefield, right?
Is it like that? Because I mean, some level, right? That's merit, or is it like a dunk tank where we're going to determine if this person's a witch?
I'm not sure what you mean by the second part of what you meant. What
well,
do you,
mean
you
by know, they determined if you were a witch back in the Salem trials. If you
by whether or not you drowned or
right,
something like
right.
that. Yeah, I mean, I think it's like that because it's not about merit. You know, like Obama believed in merit.
Right.
You know, like you work hard, the smartest person, the person who has the best product. Trump doesn't believe in any of that kind of crap. You know, he thinks the person who wins in the market is kind of like the best, I don't know what the word is, best con man, because he understood like how to manipulate the most people, and he's very honest about this. He says, I engage in what I call truthful hyperbole, because the fact of the matter is we live in a fantasy world, and what people have is a fantasy of greatness. Most people are little small people, and I give them that fantasy. That's what I am. So I'm not giving them, I'm not Steve Jobs, you know, giving them the best computer or Bill Gates or Zuckerberg, you know, designing this great, you know, social media platform. I'm not like that. I'm giving them an experience. I'm giving them a show. It's a fantasy. And they're dupes and they're pathetic, but they buy it. And that's my secret. And so it's very different, I think, from how we normally think about merit in the market, because it's not, as I say, the best product, you know, the best managerial system or anything like that. It's really, you know, the best kind of, you know, magic trick.
So from his perspective, he's going in and he's just pressing the certain buttons that he knows instinctually that, and I don't think he would say the conservative mind, I think he would just say people or a certain subset of people. And for those subset of people, they're just looking at, they buy into this notion of the market, just pops out. It's really more of like a sieve, like the quality will come out one way or another. And so if he's got the money, then he must be the champion.
Exactly. Money is the truth teller. It really reveals the truth. And, you know, in a certain way, that guy, Robert Mercer, who's this sort of obscure billionaire who Jane Mayer profiled,
yes.
Who's, you know, connected with Bannon and all these people, he says, he's quoted in that piece that she did, very saying, like, you know, the value of a person is determined by how much money they have. So in many ways, you know, Trump is playing to a very long-standing conservative Republican theme about the market. What's different, and what makes him different from someone like, say, Ayn Rand, is that they thought the market was entirely a truth teller, like that you really were the best person. Trump sometimes says that, and pushes that line, but he then takes it back and says, basically, it's the who's the biggest bullshit artist, and that's what I am. What the market really is, it's like a casino. He compares it, in fact, to a casino, right, where you're gambling at cards, and it's who can bluff the best, you know. And the only difference between a casino and a market, he says, he literally says this, is that in the stock market, on NASDAQ, they wear suits and carry briefcases. But there's no difference. And what's interesting about that comment, John Maynard Keynes, the great economist, you know, made this very famous argument back in the 20s. He said, he was talking about war profiteering, and he said the problem with profiteers is it starts convincing ordinary people that all legitimate profit is just profiteering. It's all gambling. And the minute that that happens, capitalism will have its support pulled out from beneath it, because you can't expect people to put up with inequality if they feel like the person at the top got there, you know, by gambling and profiteering. Trump, in a way, comes exactly out of that. The only difference is that he recognized that that wouldn't undermine capitalism at all. The result would be, once he told that kind of a truth, that people would flock to him because they would want to know his secret.
Well, it could undermine capitalism, right? I mean, ultimately, but he just knew that was almost like a hack in the system on some level.
Yeah, it could undermine capitalism. I mean, this gets into a much bigger question. If there's a real left there,
right,
that can then, you know, tell, you know, expose that. The problem is, you know, in the Democratic Party, you know, Obama was very different. You know, Obama famously said after the financial crisis,
turn the page.
He said, you know, I know Jamie Dimon. I know Lloyd Blankfein. Those guys are smart. You know, they're smart, talented men. You know, Obama believed in the virtue and talent of the men of Wall Street. Trump doesn't. You know, Trump doesn't at all. But because there's no real left, he gets away with saying this stuff that no conservative you'd have to go back to Teddy Roosevelt, frankly, to find any Republican president or successful candidate saying the kinds of things that Trump says about capitalism. It would have been a scandal. And it tells you something, I think, about the perilous state of the Republican Party and the conservative movement, that the person who's leading it now is so skeptical of the foundational myth upon which the party and the movement is built.
So, I mean, it's almost as if, like, he's a, you know, he's sort of, I mean, it's Penn and Teller may be unfortunate on some level, in the context of politics, to use as an example, but they're magicians up there, you know, basically giving away the trick here,
yeah.
And he is on some level too, and getting rewarded for it. He's just not quite giving up his specific trick, but he's, I mean, right? Like he was out there saying in the campaign, like, look, I know how this works because I used to be part of it. Now I'm sort of like in the ether, where I'm neither them or who I used to be. So I'm like the one guy who can float down, and I'm just the guy who's watching this transaction now, and I'm telling you about it. I'm neither the briber or the bribee at this point.
Now, the problem with all of this, I've kind of given you, I think, like, you know, what the shtick is and why it appeals, but I think there's a real problem there, which is that people elected him expecting the goods. And what those goods were, we can argue about, and it's not entirely clear, but he hasn't delivered. And so we're now in this, I think, conservative movement and the Republican Party is in this very difficult situation because he's exposed them and their myths as being myths, right? But he hasn't necessarily put anything in its place, certainly not the things he promised to put in their place. So, you know, he's sort of dancing on a wire, and his base gets smaller and smaller. So I think they're in a lot of trouble because, you know, he pulled out some of their founding myths, and they don't necessarily have anything to replace it with.
I mean, is the base getting smaller and smaller?
Well, first of all, yeah, it definitely is. I mean, the polls are showing this now, that, you know, white men without college degrees, white people in those Rust Belt states, in rural states. I mean, there was a massive poll that was just done. It was just released about 2 weeks ago, you know, huge, probably the biggest one yet. And it showed that, you know, in every single state, and in rural areas as well, he is losing support. And even more than that, the intensity of his, you know, the people who had the most intense approval ratings, that's also going down. How this all plays out in elections, we have no idea. But the donor base is very nervous. You see article after article in the Wall Street Journal and in the Financial Times where they're now saying openly, if we don't get these tax cuts, it's over. You know,
Ted Cruz said something to that effect the other day. That it would be,
yeah.
Is there lasting damage to conservative ideology? Is Trump, I mean, one of the things, it's interesting because there's so many people who are using where Trump is being used as a tool, right? Like the Republicans are saying their calculation is as long as we're willing to risk all the possible downsides, including the small confrontation in North Korea, if we can get these tax cuts. Bannon, it seems to me, is less about, you know, fighting for Trump on the outside and more about using Trump for his fight on the outside. The Republicans, I can see how it's going to hurt them in the midterm, but is it sticking to the ideology?
I think it is. First of all, they can't even act on their ideology. I still don't think people on the left have fully grasped what a cataclysmic failure the Obamacare repeal, you know, was for the right. Here they had total control over the government, and they could not act, they could not pull the trigger on something that, from the free market point of view, should have been a no-brainer. They could not bring themselves to do it. They tried. So I think right there you see that the ideology, I mean, just to give you a counterexample of what I'm talking about, in 1982, it was the worst recession since the Great Depression. Unemployment was almost at 11%. And Ronald Reagan goes on the radio, and what does he say? Does he say, we're going to pull back on the tax cuts, we're going to increase social spending to protect the safety net? Not a chance. He doubled down. He said, he talked about the magic of the market, and he said there's something. He said, I'm going to quote from that song, this could be the beginning of something big. I mean, that was the level of faith and confidence in the cause that they had. Now, here we come. They weren't able to do this massive thing on healthcare, and now we're in the tax cut question. And this, I apologize, it's going to sound a little bit wonky, but I think it's important to know the details. So George W. Bush did that massive tax cut. Remember, he did that massive tax cut when the Republicans did not control the Senate. He was able to pull that off. But there was a cap on it, which was the sunset provisions. They couldn't last past 10 years.
10 years because it couldn't meet the Byrd rule, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the Republicans have been furious about this. Ever since, they view this as a cataclysmic failure, right? Because Obama then got rid of all the big tax cuts at the top and so forth. When they got elected with total control of the government, they told themselves, "We're not doing it that way again. We're going to do permanent, what they call tax reform, which means permanent tax cuts." That was the dream, and they had total control over the government. Unlike George,
literally Paul Ryan's dream. I think he bragged about being around a keg talking about this or something.
Right, and this is why they went after Obamacare first. That was part of the whole plan. I mean, they get attacked for this now because it was a failure, but it was part of a plan. They understood that, you know, this is the holy grail, because if you make the tax cuts, if you defund, this is what's his name? Drown in the bathtub.
Norquist.
Norquist, right? You know, you have to defund the state. That's the only way to do this. And they've been successful at that over the years. So now they have total control over the government. It's already very clear that they're not going to be able to do the long-term tax thing because it involves things like getting rid of the mortgage and the local and state deduction, and the Republicans in the northern states aren't going to go for that. The best they're looking at is to do a reprise of George W. Bush. That's the very best, and it may not be even possible because Corker, the way Corker is going in all of this. And again, remember, George W. Bush did not have total control over Congress.
Right.
They do. So I think you're just seeing, and then just one last example of the weakening of the ideology. They've passed two continuing resolutions since Trump has been in office. These are funding mechanisms to keep the government going for 3 or 4 months. And in each one, They had the opportunity to do all the things they wanted to do, whether it was to defund Planned Parenthood or, you know, cut the State Department, you know, all these things. And every single time, they didn't do it. I mean, we're getting to December, and we're finishing out the year with a budget that looks almost entirely like the one that Barack Obama would have passed. That's with a party in total control of the government. So again, I think you're seeing the weakening, the fraying of the ideology, and I'm going to be watching this tax debate very carefully, because I think that's where you're going to that, you know, it's in these actions that you see how the confidence of their convictions, if they have them or not.
I mean, is that though? I mean, because all right, and we should add too that Bush's tax cuts came, if I remember correctly, in the summer of 2001. Before 9/11. So just so that everybody knows that, because it's hard to forget that. I mean, it's easy to forget that he actually, I mean, he wasn't terribly popular either. I don't recall at that time. No. People have to remember the big taste in people's mouths, at least mine maybe was a little bit more rancid, was that election. But do you think this is a function of, and what is this a function of? Is it a function of just they have overpromised? They had opportunities to cut Social Security. They could right now, if they had taken the deal from Barack Obama, following the fiscal cliff, they could have already cut some cost of living increases. Maybe they could get another cut. Like, are they suffering? It seems to me they're suffering either, and you tell me your opinion, they're either suffering from their rigidness or the multitude of opportunities they have for financing, which makes them all seemingly on the same page, but in fact working for different, you know, Mercers, Koch brothers. There's a lot of different influences. Or is it Donald Trump? Because my theory about Donald Trump is that the only difference between Donald Trump and Marco Rubio, let's say, on the Affordable Care Act, is that Manchin, Heitkamp, and maybe Donnelly are in play to jump over and vote for the Republicans, vote with the Republicans, but they couldn't because of this Russia stuff on some level that they had cover because he was in league with, you know, a traditionally big American foe.
Right. So I think there's a couple, I mean, a lot of things are in play, but I want to just focus on two. The first is, I think the kind of absence of a real left, I think, is very important. And here's why. There have always been factions and very rigid ideological factions within the Republican Party. If anything, the Republican Party was far more divided ideologically back in 1981, let's say, than it is now. But what held those factions together and what enabled the party to kind of move forward was that there was a very clear enemy, which was the New Deal and the welfare state. And it had to be destroyed. And that enemy has a disciplining effect on you, as you know, as any sort of soldier will tell you. It forces a kind of solidarity upon, you know, a unity on you, and it also forces you to think smarter and sharper and to make the arguments better. And that's the way, you know, the conservative movement developed. This goes way back to the 60s, in fact, when there was this whole movement for what was called fusion. How do you bring together these free marketeers with these social conservatives, with these hardcore anti-communists who want to build up the military? All these crazy factions, but they were able to do it because, you know, and it culminates in Ronald Reagan, we have this enemy, this common enemy, all of us. We may have different priorities, but our enemy is the same. What happens when that enemy disappears? There's a scramble that sets in, and every faction says, I want more. So then you have a kind of rigidification of these factions that sets in, and the suppleness disappears. And I think that has really had a huge effect. I mean, the way the Freedom Caucus totally screwed the negotiations over Obamacare throughout those first couple of months, you know, they were going for broke.
Right.
And you can see why they were. They said, you know, for God's sakes, we've got total control of the government. We've been saying we believe this. Do we believe this or don't we believe this? You all voted for it. So you could see exactly why they pushed so hard. But then all of a sudden, you know, you got the other side pulling back. And, you know, I think that has the lack of a left. And when I say the lack of a left, I don't mean the lack of a Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party is around, and sometimes it can be very effective electorally. I mean a real left against which the right formed all of its basic ideas. And I think that has had a big part of this. The second part of it, I think, is what you're talking about with Trump, although I see him as a symptom. And here we get into something that, you know, there's a weird irony. So part of why Trump seemed illegitimate from day one, I don't think was just about Russia. I think it was also the racial dog whistling. And more than dog whistling, the racial, really hardcore, nasty, racist commentary. I mean, some of the weakest moments for Trump have been Charlottesville and this NFL thing. It has not increased his base. And I think that sense of illegitimacy, that stain of illegitimacy about him, which I don't think is predominantly necessary from Russia, the Russia thing, I think it was because he kind of broke a code that you weren't supposed to break. And I think that has made him weak in many, many ways, and has made it easier for the Democrats to hold together and not to give an inch to him on these other things. I mean, it's kind of astounding that not a single Democrat broke on Obamacare. And I don't want to make predictions. I wouldn't be surprised if not a single Democrat breaks on the tax cuts. In the Senate, at least. I don't know as much about the House.
Yeah, I mean, that to me seems to be the key, right? It's like it's just what those two or three do. I mean, you know, when we look back on those, back during the Bush years, there was like a half a dozen people to a dozen people in the Senate where you'd be like, they're going to defect.
Bush got, I think, the votes for the tax cuts. He got like 58 votes. There were 49 Republicans because Jeffers had jumped by that point. Yeah. So you know, that tells you something.
Yep.
It doesn't exist anymore. But again, it's not just Trump that does this. It's the GOP. Like he is now the GOP. You know,
right.
That's and what's interesting, and here's for me is the true irony is he was the best they could do. So this colossal, spectacular failure we're seeing, right, this guy who's not been able to deliver on some of the most basic promises, not all of them, obviously, but some of them, that was the bet. Like that put them over the top because then we come back to that wild, chaotic style of his, right? That's what energized people at the base and got them excited, you know? And without that, Jeb Bush, you know, he would have been clobbered.
Right.
Rubio, all those guys would have been destroyed, I think, in a general election.
I agree with that. Well, I guess I'm just a little bit nervous for saying so far he's a failure. Let's hope that maintains at least for a while.
I try to be careful in the book about making predictions because they often turn out to be wrong. I thought he was going to lose the election. He won the election.
Yes.
But I think if you look at, what I think you can confidently say is, we're approaching the 1 year anniversary of his election. And if you look back and compare him to almost virtually any other modern president, he has been by far the weakest president. There was just an article the other day, yesterday, I don't know if it was the Financial Times or somewhere, saying, this is a president who has issued more executive orders since anybody at this point, since in 50 years. That is not a sign of strength.
Right.
That is a sign of weakness. Barack Obama wound up issuing executive orders, especially in his second term, because he had no more control over Congress.
Yep.
But Congress was not, it was in the hands of the opposition.
That's right.
At that point. Trump's Congress is in the hands of his own party, and he's forced this route of executive orders. Again, that is a sign of a very weak president.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens to the dynamic if the Democrats can take back one or both. I don't know if there's a chance really for both, but if they're even if one, it'll be fascinating. The book is The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Donald Trump. This is the second edition, which has been updated with Donald Trump. Who knows? You may have to write a third one.
After this. This is it for me.
Did you really think you'd be writing that second one?
No.
6 months out, a year out? So, But Corey Robin, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Welcome back. Michael Brooks here. That was Corey Robin, of course. We're going to go to the fun half where we will take your call, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IMs are open. Become a member of the Majority Report today. That's how this show happens. You become our collective bosses. Majority.fm/become a member. Subscribe to the show on iTunes. Check us out on YouTube. Tonight, live, 7 p.m., Michael Brooks Show. Hope you'll check it out. If you're going to use Amazon or some type of link business, that might be useful for you. That helps the show out. JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade, coffee, tea, chocolate. Try the Majority Report blend. You know all this good stuff. Tomorrow, there's no public show. It's just members only. Only dessert.
Sorry, freebies.
Sorry. But, you know, in a certain sense, it's your choice.
You probably just have to listen to this because you don't want to pay for what's going on tomorrow, so you're listening to today's show.
You're just listening to it again. You're just going over it again. Again and again, into the abyss. I mean, especially with this, if you email and you need help, which we all obviously have needed, most of us have needed in our lives, you could even get a freebie membership. But if you can do it, please do become a member of the Majority Report. See you on the fun half.
No, 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 no. Things are looking bad.